directions to the house until Szilard thought to ask for it in Einstein's name. We were on the point of giving up and going back to New York. Two world-class Hungarians lost among country lanes in summer heat. When I saw a boy aged maybe 7 or 8 standing on the curb, I leaned out of the window and I said, "Say, do you by any chance know where Professor Einstein lives?" The boy knew that, and he offered to take us there. C.P. Snow had visited Einstein at the same summer retreat 2 years before, also losing his way, and makes the scene familiar. He came into the sitting room a minute or two after we arrived. There was no furniture, apart from some garden chairs and a small table. The window looked out onto the water, but the shutters were half closed to keep out the heat. The humidity was very high. At close quarters, Einstein's head was as I had imagined it, magnificent, with a humanizing touch of the comic, great furrowed forehead, aureole of white hair, enormous bulging chocolate eyes. I can't guess what I should have expected from such a face if I hadn't known. A shrewd Swiss once said it had the brightness of a good artisan's countenance, that he looked like a reliable, old-fashioned watchmaker in a small town who perhaps collected butterflies on a Sunday. What did surprise me was his physique. He had come in from sailing and was wearing nothing but a pair of shorts. It was a massive body, very heavily muscled. He was running to fat around the midriff and in the upper arms, rather like a footballer in middle age, but he was still an unusually strong man. He was cordial, simple, utterly unshy. The large eyes looked at me as though he was thinking, "What had I come for? What did I want to talk about?" The hours went on. I have a hazy memory that several people drifted in and out of the room, but I do not remember who they were. Stifling heat. There appeared to be no set time for meals. He was already, I think, eating very little, but he was still smoking his pipe. Trays of open sandwiches, various kinds of Wurst, cheese, cucumber, came in every now and then. It was all casual and Central European. We drank nothing but soda water. Similarly settled, Szilard told Einstein about the Columbia secondary neutron experiments and his calculations toward a chain reaction in uranium and graphite. Long after, he would recall his surprise that Einstein had not yet heard of the possibility of a chain reaction. When he mentioned it, Einstein interjected, "Daran hab ich gar nicht gedacht." I never thought of that. He was nevertheless, says Szilard, very quick to see the implications, and perfectly willing to do anything that needed to be done. He was willing to assume responsibility for sounding the alarm, even though it was quite possible that the alarm might prove to be a false alarm. The one thing most scientists are really afraid of is to make fools of themselves. Einstein was free from such a fear, and this, above all, is what made his position unique on this occasion. Einstein hesitated to write Queen Elizabeth, but was willing to contact an acquaintance who was a member of the Belgian cabinet. Wigner spoke up to insist again that the United States government should be alerted, pointing out, Szilard goes on, that we should not approach a foreign government without giving the State Department an opportunity to object. Wigner suggested that they send the Belgian letter with a cover letter through State. All three men thought that made sense. Einstein dictated a letter to the Belgian ambassador, a more formal contact appropriate to their State Department plan, and Wigner took it down in longhand in German. At the same time, Szilard drafted a cover letter. Einstein's was the first of several such compositions. They served in succession as drafts, and the origin of most of the statements that ultimately found their way into the letter he actually sent. Wigner carried the first Einstein draft back to Princeton, translated it into English, and on Monday gave it to his secretary to type. When it was ready, he mailed it to Szilard. Then he left Princeton to drive to California on vacation. A message from Gustav Stolper awaited Szilard at the King's Crown. "He reported to me," Szilard wrote Einstein on July 19th, "that he had discussed our problems with Dr. Alexander Sachs, a vice president of the Lehman Corporation, biologist and national economist, and that Dr. Sachs wanted to talk to me about this matter. Eagerly, Szilard arranged an appointment. Alexander Sachs, born in Russia, was then 46 years old. He had come to the United States when he was 11, graduated from Columbia in biology at 19, worked as a clerk on Wall Street, returned to Columbia to study philosophy, and then went on to Harvard, with several prestigious fellowships to pursue philosophy, jurisprudence, and sociology. He contributed economics text to Franklin Roosevelt's campaign speeches in 1932. Beginning in 1933, he worked for 3 years for the National Recovery Administration, joining the Lehman Corporation in 1936. He had thick curls and a receding chin, and looked and sounded like the comedian Ed Wynn. His associates at the NRA used to point him out to visiting firemen under that nom de guerre as ultimate proof, if the NRA itself was not sufficient, of Roosevelt's gift for radical innovation. Sachs communicated in dense, florid prose. He had been thinking that spring of writing a book entitled The Interwar Retreat from Reason as Exemplified in the Mishistory of the Recent Past and in the Contemporaneous Conduct of International Political and Economic Affairs by the United States and Great Britain, but could coruscate in committee. Sachs heard Szilard out. Then, as Szilard wrote Einstein, he took the position, and completely convinced me, that these were matters which first and foremost concerned the White House, and that the best thing to do, also from the practical point of view, was to inform Roosevelt. He said that if we gave him a statement, he would make sure it reached Roosevelt in person. Among those who valued Sachs's opinions and called him from time to time for talks, it seems, was the President of the United States. Szilard was stunned. The very boldness of the proposal won his heart, after all the months when he had confronted caution and skepticism. "Although I have seen Dr. Sachs once," he told Einstein, "and really was not able to form any judgment about him, I nevertheless think that it could not do any harm to try this way, and I also think that in this regard he is in a position to fulfill his promise." Szilard met Sachs shortly after returning from Peconic, between Sunday and Wednesday. Unable at midweek to reach Wigner en route to California, he tracked down Teller, who thought Sachs' proposal preferable to the plan they had previously worked out. Drawing on the first Einstein draft, Szilard now prepared a draft letter to Roosevelt. He wrote it in German because Einstein's English was insecure, added a cover letter, and mailed it to Long Island. "Perhaps you will be able to tell me over the telephone whether you would like to return the draft with your marginal comments by mail," he proposed in the cover letter, "or whether I should come out to discuss the whole thing once more with you." If he visited Peconic again, Szilard wrote, he would ask Teller to drive him, "not only because I believe his advice is valuable, but also because I think you might enjoy getting to know him. He is particularly nice." Einstein preferred to review a letter to the president in person. Teller, therefore, delivered Szilard to Peconic probably on Sunday, July 30th, in his sturdy 1935 Plymouth. "I entered history as Szilard's chauffeur," Teller aphorizes the experience. They found the Princeton laureate in old clothes and slippers. Elsa Einstein served tea. Szilard and Einstein composed a third text together, which Teller wrote down. "Yes, yes," Teller remembers Einstein commenting. "This would be the first time that man releases nuclear energy in a direct form rather than indirectly." Directly from fission, he meant, rather than indirectly from the sun, where a different nuclear reaction produces the copious radiation that reaches the Earth as sunlight. Einstein apparently questioned if Sachs was the best man to carry the news to Roosevelt. On August 2nd, Szilard wrote Einstein hoping, at long last, for a decision upon whom we should try to get as middleman. He had seen Sachs in the interim. The economist, who certainly coveted the assignment of representing Albert Einstein to the president, had generously listed the financier Bernard Baruch or Carl T. Compton, the president of MIT, as possible alternates. On the other hand, he had strongly endorsed Charles Lindbergh, though he must have known that Roosevelt despised the famous aviator for his outspoken pro-German isolationism. Szilard wrote that he and Sachs had discussed a somewhat longer and more extensive version of the letter Einstein had written with Szilard at their second Peconic meeting. He now enclosed both the longer and shorter versions and asked Einstein to return his favorite, along with a letter of introduction to Lindbergh. Einstein opted for the longer version, which incorporated the shorter statement that had originated with him, but carried additional paragraphs contributed by Szilard in consultation with Sachs. He signed both letters and returned them to Szilard in less than a week, with a note hoping that you will finally overcome your inner resistance. It's always questionable to try to do something too cleverly. That is, be bold and get moving. We will try to follow your advice, Szilard rejoined on August 9th, and as far as possible overcome our inner resistances, which admittedly exist. Incidentally, we are surely not trying to be too clever, and will be quite satisfied if only we don't look too stupid. Szilard transmitted the letter in its final form to Sachs on August 15th with a memorandum of his own that elaborated on the letter's discussion of the possibilities and dangers of fission. He had not given up contacting Lindbergh. He drafted a letter to the aviator the following day, but he seems to have decided to try Sachs in the meantime, probably in the interest of moving the project on. He pointedly asked Sachs either to deliver the letter to Roosevelt or to return it. One of the discussions Szilard had added to the longer draft that Einstein chose concerned who should serve as liaison between the administration and the group of physicists working on chain reactions in America. In his letter of transmittal to Sachs, Szilard now tacitly offered himself for that service. If a man, having courage and imagination, could be found, he wrote, and if such a man were put, in accordance with Dr. Einstein's suggestion, in the position to act with some measure of authority in this matter, this would certainly be an important step forward. In order that you may be able to see of what assistance such a man could be in our work, allow me please to give you a short account of the past history of the case. The short account that followed, an abbreviated and implicit curriculum vitae, essentially outlined Szilard's own role since Bohr's announcement of the discovery of fission 7 crowded months earlier. Szilard's offer was as innocent of American bureaucratic politics as it was bold. It was surely also the apotheosis of his drive to save the world. By this time, the Hungarians at least believed they saw major humanitarian benefit inherent in what Eugene Wigner would describe in retrospect as a horrible military weapon, explaining, "Although none of us spoke much about it to the authorities during this early period, they considered us dreamers enough as it was, we did hope for another effect of the development of atomic weapons in addition to the warding off of imminent disaster. We realized that, should atomic weapons be developed, no two nations would be able to live in peace with each other unless their military forces were controlled by a common higher authority. We expected that these controls, if they were effective enough to abolish atomic warfare, would be effective enough to abolish also all other forms of war. This hope was almost as strong a spur to our endeavors as was our fear of becoming the victims of the enemy's atomic bombings. From the horrible weapon which they were about to urge the United States to develop, Szilard, Teller, and Wigner, the Hungarian conspiracy, Merrill Tuve was amused to call them, hoped for more than deterrence against German aggression. They also hoped for world government and world peace, conditions they imagined bombs made of uranium might enforce. Alexander Sachs intended to read aloud to the president when he met with him. He believed busy people saw so much paper, they tended to dismiss the printed word. "Our social system is such," he told a Senate committee in 1945, "that any public figure is punch drunk with printer's ink." This was a matter that the commander-in-chief and the head of the nation must know. "I could only do it if I could see him for a long stretch and read the material so it came in by way of the ear, not as a soft mascara on the eye." He needed a full hour of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's time. History intervened to crowd the president's calendar. Having won the Rhineland, Austria, and Czechoslovakia simply by taking them, having signed the Pact of Steel with Italy on May 22nd, and a 10-year treaty of non-aggression and neutrality with the USSR on August 23rd, Adolf Hitler ordered the invasion of Poland, beginning at 4:45 a.m. on September 1, 1939, and precipitated the Second World War. The German invasion fielded 56 divisions against 30 Polish divisions strung thinly along the long Polish frontier. Hitler had 10 times the aircraft, including plentiful squadrons of Stuka dive bombers and 9 divisions of panzer tanks, against Polish horse cavalry armed with swords and spears. The assault was a perfect specimen of the modern blitzkrieg, writes Winston Churchill. The close interaction on the battlefield of army and air force, the violent bombardment of all communications and of any town that seems an attractive target, the arming of an active fifth column, the free use of spies and parachutists, and above all, the irresistible forward thrusts of great masses of armor. The mathematician Stanislaw Ulam had just returned from visiting Poland, bringing with him on a student visa his 16-year-old brother, Adam. Adam and I were staying in a hotel on Columbus Circle. It was a very hot, humid New York night. I could not sleep very well. It must have been around 1 or 2 in the morning when the telephone rang. Dazed and perspiring, very uncomfortable, I picked up the receiver, and the somber, throaty voice of my friend, the topologist Witold Hurwicz, began to recite the horrible tale of the start of war. "Warsaw has been bombed. The war has begun," he said. This is how I learned about the beginning of World War II. He kept describing what he had heard on the radio. I turned on my own. Adam was asleep. I did not wake him. There would be time to tell him the news in the morning. Our father and sister were in Poland, so were many other relatives. At that moment, I suddenly felt as if a curtain had fallen on my past life, cutting it off from my future. There has never been a different color and meaning to everything ever since. One of Roosevelt's first acts was to appeal to the belligerents to refrain from bombing civilian populations. Revulsion against the bombing of cities had grown in the United States since at least the Japanese bombing of Shanghai in 1937. When Spanish fascists bombed Barcelona in March 1938, Secretary of State Cordell Hull had condemned the atrocity publicly. "No theory of war can justify such conduct," he told reporters. "I feel that I'm speaking for the whole American people." In June, the Senate passed a resolution condemning the inhuman bombing of civilian populations. As war approached, revulsion began to give way to impulses of revenge. In the summer of 1939, Herbert Hoover could urge an international ban on the bombing of cities and still argue that one of the impelling reasons for the unceasing building of bombing planes is to prepare reprisals. Bombing was bad because it was enemy bombing. Scientific American saw through to a darker truth. Although aerial bombing remains an unknown, indeterminate quantity, the world may be sure that the unwholesome atrocities which are happening today are but curtain raisers on insane dramas to come. So although Roosevelt had asked Congress for increased funds for long-range bombers 9 months before, in appealing to the belligerents on September 1, 1939, he could still articulate the moral indignation of millions of Americans. The ruthless bombing from the air of civilians in unfortified centers of population during the course of the hostilities which have raged in various quarters of the earth during the past few years, which has resulted in the maiming and in the death of thousands of defenseless men, women, and children, has sickened the hearts of every civilized man and woman and has profoundly shocked the conscience of humanity. If resort is had to this form of inhuman barbarism during the period of the tragic conflagration which with the world is now confronted, hundreds of thousands of innocent human beings who have no possibility for and who are not even remotely participating in the hostilities which have now broken out will lose their lives. I am therefore addressing this urgent appeal to every government which may be engaged in hostilities publicly to affirm its determination that its armed forces shall in no event and under no circumstances undertake the bombardment from the air of civilian populations or of unfortified cities upon the understanding that these same rules of warfare will be scrupulously observed by all of their opponents. I request an immediate reply." Great Britain agreed to the president's terms the same day. Germany, busy bombing Warsaw, concurred on September 18th. The invasion of Poland brought Britain and France into the war on September 3rd. Abruptly, Roosevelt's schedule filled to overflowing. In early September, in particular, he was working overtime with a reluctant Congress to revise the Neutrality Act to terms more favorable to Britain. Saxe was unable even to discuss arranging an interview until after the first week in September. By September, Kurt Deibner's new War Office Department had consolidated German fission research under its authority. Deibner enlisted a young Leipzig theoretician named Erich Bagg, and together the two physicists planned a secret conference to consider the feasibility of a weapons project. They had the authority to enlist the services of any German citizen they wished, and they used it, sending out papers that left Hans Geiger, Walter Botha, Otto Hahn, and a number of other exceptional older men nervously uncertain if they were being invited to Berlin for consultation or ordered to active military service. At the conference in Berlin on September 16th, the physicists learned that German intelligence had discovered the beginnings of uranium research abroad, meaning presumably in the United States and Britain. They discussed the long, thorough theoretical paper by Niels Bohr and John Wheeler, The Mechanism of Nuclear Fission, that had been published in the September Physical Review, and especially its conclusion, which Bohr and Wheeler had elaborated from Bohr's Sunday morning graph work, that U-235 was probably the isotope of uranium responsible for slow neutron fission. Hahn, like Bohr, argued that isotope separation was difficult to the point of impossibility. Bagg proposed calling in Werner Heisenberg, his superior at Leipzig, to adjudicate. Heisenberg therefore attended a second Berlin conference on September 26th and discussed two possible ways to harness the energy from fission: by slowing secondary neutrons with a moderator to make a uranium burner, and by separating U-235 to make an explosive. Paul Hartek, the Hamburg physicist who had written the War Office the previous April, traveled to the second conference armed with a paper he had just finished on the importance of layering uranium and moderator to avoid the U-238 capture resonance, the same insight that had come independently to Fermi and Szilard in early July. Hartek's study, however, considered using heavy water as a moderator. Even though Hartek had worked with Rutherford at the Cavendish and knew from personal experience how expensive heavy water production could be, water in which deuterium replaced hydrogen had to be tediously distilled from tons of ordinary H2O. Deibner and Bagg had outlined for the second conference a preparatory working plan for initiating experiments on the exploitation of nuclear fission. Heisenberg would head up theoretical investigation. Bagg would measure deuterium's cross-section for collision to establish how effectively heavy water might slow secondary neutrons. Hartek would look into isotope separation. Others would experiment to determine other significant nuclear constants. The War Office would take over the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute of Physics, finished in 1937 and beautifully equipped. Adequate funds would be forthcoming. The German atomic bomb project was well begun. It may have been no less complicated by humanitarian ambiguities than the project the Hungarians in the United States proposed. One young but highly respected German physicist involved in the work from near the beginning was Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, the son of the German Undersecretary of State. In a 1978 memoir, von Weizsäcker remembers discussing the possibility of a bomb with Otto Hahn in the spring of 1939. Hahn opposed the secrecy, then partly on the grounds of scientific ethics, but also partly because he felt that if it were to be made, it would be worse for the entire world, even for Germany, if Hitler were to be the only one to have it. Like Szilard, Teller, and Wegener, von Weizsäcker remembers realizing in discussions with a friend that this discovery could not fail to radically change the political structure of the world. To a person finding himself at the beginning of an era, its simple fundamental structures may become visible like a distant landscape in the flash of a single stroke of lightning. But the path toward them in the dark is long and confusing. At that time, 1939, we were faced with a very simple logic. Wars waged with atom bombs as regularly recurring events, that is to say, nuclear wars as institutions, do not seem reconcilable with the survival of the participating nations. But the atom bomb exists. It exists in the minds of some men. According to the historically known logic of armaments and power systems, it will soon make its physical appearance. If that is so, then the participating nations, and ultimately mankind itself, can only survive if war as an institution is abolished. Both sides might work from fear of the other, but some on both sides would be working also paradoxically, believing they were preparing a new force that would ultimately bring peace to the world. As September extended its violence, Szilard grew impatient. He had heard nothing from Alexander Sachs. Pursuing Sachs's previous suggestions and his own leads, he arranged for Eugene Wigner to give him a letter of introduction to MIT President Carl T. Compton, recontacted a businessman of possible influence whom he had once interested in the Einstein-Szilard refrigerator pump, read a newspaper account of a Lindbergh speech, and reported to Einstein that the aviator is, in fact, not our man. Finally, the last week in September, he and Wigner visited Sachs and found to their dismay that the economist still held Einstein's letter. He says he has spoken repeatedly with Roosevelt's secretary, Szilard reported to Einstein on October 3rd, and has the impression that Roosevelt is so overburdened that it would be wiser to see him at a later date. He intends to go to Washington this week. The two Hungarians were ready to start over. There is a distinct possibility that Sachs will be of no use to us. If this is the case, we must put the matter in someone else's hands. Wegener and I have decided to accord Sachs 10 days' grace. Then I will write you again and let you know how matters stand. But Alexander Sachs did indeed travel to Washington, not that week, but the next, and on Wednesday, October 11th, presented himself, probably in the late afternoon, at the White House. Roosevelt's aide, General Edwin M. Watson, pa to Roosevelt and his intimates, sitting with his own executive secretary and military aide, reviewed Sachs's agenda. When he was convinced that the information was worth the president's time, Watson let Sachs into the Oval Office. "Alex," Roosevelt hailed him, "what are you up to?" Sachs liked to warm up the president with jokes. His sense of humor tended to learned parables. Now he told Roosevelt the story of the young American inventor who wrote a letter to Napoleon. The inventor proposed to build the emperor a fleet of ships that carried no sail, but could attack England in any weather. He had it in his power to deliver Napoleon's armies to England in a few hours without fear of wind or storm, he wrote, and he was prepared to submit his plans. Napoleon scoffed, "Ships without sails, bah! Away with your visionists!" The young inventor, Sachs concluded, was Robert Fulton. Roosevelt laughed easily. Probably he laughed at that. Sachs cautioned the president to listen carefully. What he had now to impart was at least the equivalent of the steamboat inventor's proposal to Napoleon. Not yet ready to listen, Roosevelt scribbled a message and summoned an aide. Shortly, the aide returned with a treasure, a carefully wrapped bottle of Napoleon brandy that the Roosevelts had preserved in the family for years. The president poured two glasses, passed one to his visitor, toasted him, and settled back. Sachs had made a file for Roosevelt's reading of Einstein's letter and Szilard's memorandum, but neither document had suited his sense of how to present the information to a busy president. "I'm an economist, Not a scientist, he would tell friends, but I had a prior relationship with the president, and Szilard and Einstein agreed I was the right person to make the relevant, elaborate scientific material intelligible to Mr. Roosevelt. No scientist could sell it to him. Sachs had therefore prepared his own version of the fission story, a composite and paraphrase of the contents of the Einstein and Szilard presentations. Though he left those statements with Roosevelt, he read neither one of them aloud. He read not Einstein's subsequently famous letter, but his own 800-word summation, the first authoritative report to a head of state of the possibility of using nuclear energy to make a weapon of war. It emphasized power production first, radioactive materials for medical use second, and bombs of hitherto unenvisaged potency and scope third. It recommended making arrangements with Belgium for uranium supplies and expanding and accelerating experiment, but imagine that American industry or private foundations would be willing to foot the bill. To that end, it proposed that Roosevelt designate an individual and a committee to serve as a liaison between the scientists and the administration. Sachs had intentionally listed the peaceful potentials of fission first and second among its prospects. To emphasize the ambivalence of the discovery, he said later, the two poles of good and evil it embodied, he turned near the end of the discussion to Francis Aston's 1936 lecture, 40 Years of Atomic Theory. It had been published in 1938 as part of a collection, Background to Modern Science, which Sachs had brought along to the White House, where the English spectroscopist had ridiculed the more elderly and ape-like of our prehistoric ancestors who objected to the innovation of cooked food and pointed out the grave dangers attending the use of the newly discovered agency fire. Sachs read the entire last paragraph of the lecture to Roosevelt, emphasizing the final sentences. Personally, I think there is no doubt that subatomic energy is available all around us, and that one day man will release and control its almost infinite power. We cannot prevent him from doing so, and can only hope that he will not use it exclusively in blowing up his next-door neighbor. Alex, said Roosevelt, quickly understanding, what you are after is to see that the Nazis don't blow us up. Precisely, Sachs said. Roosevelt called in Watson. This requires action, he told his aide. Meeting afterward with Sachs, Watson went by the book. He proposed a committee consisting initially of the director of the Bureau of Standards, an Army representative, and a Navy representative. The Bureau of Standards, established by Act of Congress in 1901, is the nation's physics laboratory, charged with applying science and technology in the national interest and for public benefit. Its director in 1939 was Dr. Lyman J. Briggs, a Johns Hopkins Ph.D. and a government scientist for 43 years, who had been nominated by Herbert Hoover and appointed by FDR. The military representatives were Lieutenant Colonel Keith F. Adamson and Commander Gilbert C. Hoover, both ordnance experts. "Don't let Alex go without seeing me again," Roosevelt had directed Watson. Sachs met the same evening with Briggs, briefed him, and proposed he and his committee of two get together with the physicists working on fission. Briggs agreed. Sachs saw the president again and declared himself satisfied. That was good enough for Roosevelt. Briggs set a first meeting of the Advisory Committee on Uranium for October 21st in Washington, a Saturday. Sachs proposed to invite the émigrés. To counterbalance them, Briggs invited Tuve, who found a schedule conflict and deputized Richard Roberts as his stand-in. Fermi, still nursing his Navy grievance, refused to attend, but was willing to allow Teller to speak in his behalf. On the appointed day, the Hungarian conspiracy breakfasted with Sachs at the Carlton Hotel, the out-of-towners having arrived the night before. From the hotel, they proceeded to the Department of Commerce. The meeting then counted 9 participants, Briggs, a Briggs assistant, Sachs, Szilard, Wigner, Teller, Roberts, Adamson for the Army, and Hoover for the Navy. Szilard began by emphasizing the possibility of a chain reaction in a uranium-graphite system. Whether such a system would work, he said, depended on the capture cross-section of carbon, and that was not yet sufficiently known. If the value was large, they would know that a large-scale experiment would fail. If the value was extremely small, a large-scale experiment would look highly promising. An intermediate value would necessitate a large-scale experiment to decide. He estimated the destructive potential of a uranium bomb to be as much as 20,000 tons of high explosive equivalent. Such a bomb, he had written in the memorandum Sachs carried to Roosevelt, would depend on fast neutrons and might be too heavy to be transported by airplane, which meant he was still thinking of exploding natural uranium, not of separating U-235. Adamson, openly contemptuous, butted in. "In Aberdeen," Teller remembers him sneering, "we have a goat tethered to a stick with a 10-foot rope, and we have promised a big prize to anyone who can kill the goat with a death ray. Nobody has claimed the prize yet." As for 20,000 tons of high explosive, the Army officer said, he'd been standing outside an ordnance depot once when it blew up and it hadn't even knocked him down. Restraining himself, Wigner spoke after Szilard, supporting his compatriot's argument. Roberts raised serious objection. He was convinced that Szilard's optimism for a chain reaction was premature, and his notion of a fast neutron weapon made of natural uranium misguided. Roberts had co-authored a review of this subject just 1 month before. It agreed with Szilard that there are not yet sufficient data to say definitely whether or not a uranium powerhouse is a possibility. But it also assessed, because the DTM had begun assessing, the question of the fast neutron fission of natural uranium and found, because of resonance capture and extensive scattering of fast neutrons, that it was very unlikely that the fast neutrons can produce a sufficient number of fissions to maintain a chain reaction. The DTM physicist also pointed out that other lines of research might be more promising than a slow neutron chain reaction in natural uranium. He meant isotope separation. At the University of Virginia, Jesse Beams, formerly Ernest Lawrence's colleague at Yale, was applying to the task the high-speed centrifuges he was developing there. Roberts thought answers to these questions might require several years of work and that research should be left in the meantime to the universities. Briggs spoke up to defend his committee. He argued vigorously that any assessment of the possibilities of fission at a time when Europe was at war had to include more than physics. It had to include the potential impact of the development on national defense. Szilard was astonished as he told Pegram the next day at Sachs's active and enthusiastic participation in the meeting. Sachs seconded Briggs and the Hungarians. The issue was too important to wait, he recalled his argument, and the important thing was to be helpful, because if there was something to it, there was danger of our being blown up. We had to take time by the forelock, and we had to be ahead. Then it was Teller's turn. For himself, he announced in his deep, heavily accented voice, he strongly supported Szilard. But he had also been given the task of serving as messenger for Fermi and Tuve, who had discussed these issues in New York and had come to some agreement about them. I said that this needed a little support. In particular, we needed to acquire a good substance to slow down the neutrons. Therefore, we needed pure graphite, and this is expensive. Jesse Beam's centrifuge work also required support, Teller added. How much money do you need? Commander Hoover wanted to know. Szilard had not planned to ask for money. The diversion of government funds for such purposes as ours appears to be hardly possible, he explained to Pegram the next day, and I have therefore myself avoided to make any such recommendation. But Teller answered Hoover promptly, probably speaking for Fermi. For the first year of this research, we need $6,000, mostly in order to buy the graphite. My friends blamed me because the great enterprise of nuclear energy was to start with such a pittance, Teller reminisces. They haven't forgiven me yet. Szilard, who would write Briggs on October 26th that the graphite alone for a large-scale experiment would cost at least $33,000, must have been appalled. Adamson had anticipated just such a raid on the public treasury. At this point, says Szilard, the representative of the Army started a rather longish tirade. He told us that it was naive to believe that we could make a significant contribution to defense by creating a new weapon. He said that if a new weapon is created, it usually takes two wars before one can know whether the weapon is any good or not. Then he explained rather laboriously that it is in the end not weapons which win the wars, but the morale of the troops. He went on in this vein for a long time, until suddenly Wigner, the most polite of us, interrupted him. Wigner said in his high-pitched voice that it was very interesting for him to hear this. He always thought that weapons were very important, and that this is what costs money, and this is why the army needs such a large appropriation. But he was very interested to hear that he was wrong. It's not weapons, but the morale which wins the wars, and if this is correct, perhaps one should take a second look at the budget of the army, and maybe the budget could be cut.
All right, Adamson snapped. You'll get your money.
The Uranium Committee produced a report for the president on November 1st. It narrowly emphasized exploring a controlled chain reaction as a continuous source of power in submarines. In addition, it noted, if the reaction turns out to be explosive in character, it would provide a possible source of bombs, with a destructiveness vastly greater than anything now known. The committee recommended adequate support for a thorough investigation. Initially, the government might undertake to supply 4 tons of pure graphite. This would allow Fermi and Szilard to measure the capture cross-section of carbon, and, if justified later, 50 tons of uranium oxide. Briggs heard from Pa Watson on November 17th. The president had read the report, Watson wrote, and wanted to keep it on file. On file is where it remained, mute and inactive, well into 1940. Even with Szilard and Fermi stalled, fission studies continued at many other American laboratories. Prodded by a late October letter from Fermi, for example, Alfred Nyer at the University of Minnesota finally began preparing to separate enough U-235 from U-238 using his mass spectroscope to determine experimentally which isotope is responsible for slow neutron fission. But to American physicists and administrators in and out of government, a bomb of uranium seemed a remote possibility at best. However intense their sympathies, the war was still a European war. 11. Cross sections. In the days before the war, Otto Frisch remembers, in Hamburg with Otto Stern, he used to run experiments by day and think intensely about physics well into the night. I regularly came home, Frisch told an interviewer once, had dinner at 7, had a quarter of an hour's nap after dinner, and then I sat down happily with a sheet of paper and a reading lamp and worked until about 1 o'clock at night, until I began to have hallucinations. I began to see queer animals against the background of my room, and then I thought, oh, well, better go to bed. The young Austrian's hypnagogic visions were unpleasant feelings, but otherwise it was an ideal life. I'd never had such a pleasant life, ever. This concentrated 5 hours work every night. Through the spring of 1939, in contrast, after his early experiments with fission, Frisch found himself in a state of complete doldrums. I had a feeling war was coming. What was the use of doing any research? I simply couldn't brace myself. I was in a pretty bad state, feeling nothing I start now is going to be any good. As his aunt, Lise Meitner, worried about her isolation in Stockholm, Frisch worried about his vulnerability in Copenhagen. When British colleagues visited, he uncharacteristically campaigned among them. I first spoke to Blackett and then Oliphant when they passed through Copenhagen, and said that I had a fear that Denmark would soon be overrun by Hitler, and if so, would there be a chance for me to go to England in time? Because I'd rather work for England than do nothing, or be compelled in some way or other to work for Hitler, or be sent to a concentration camp. Mark Oliphant directed the physics department at the University of Birmingham. Rather than initiate some complicated sponsorship, he simply invited Frisch to visit him that summer to talk over the problem. So I packed 2 small suitcases and traveled by ship and train, just like any tourist. The war overtook him, safe in the English Midlands, but with nothing more of his possessions on hand than the contents of his two small suitcases. His friends in Copenhagen had to store his belongings and arrange the repossession of the piano he was buying. Oliphant found him work as an auxiliary lecturer. In that relative security, he began to think about physics again. Fission still intrigued him. He lacked the neutron source he would need for direct attack, but he had followed Bohr's theoretical work. The distinction between the fissile characteristics of U-235 and U-238 in February, the major Bohr-Wheeler paper in September, just as the German invasion of Poland brought war, a great feeling of tense sobriety. He wondered if Bohr was right, that U-235 was the isotope responsible for slow neutron fission. He conceived a way to find out by preparing a sample of uranium in which the proportions of the two isotopes were changed. That meant at least partly separating the isotopes, as Fermi and Dunning had encouraged Nyer to do for the same reason. Frisch read up on methods. The simplest, he decided, was gaseous thermal diffusion, a technique developed by the German physical chemist Klaus Clusius. For equipment, it required little more than a long tube standing on end with a heated rod inside running down its center. Fill the tube with some gaseous form of the material to be separated. Cool the tube wall by flushing it with water, and material enriched in the lighter isotope would accumulate near the top, while the heavier isotope would tend to go to the bottom. Frisch set out to assemble his Clusius tube. Progress was slow. He planned to make the tube of glass, but the laboratory glassblower's first priority was Oliphant's secret war work, work about which Frisch, technically an enemy alien, was not supposed to know. Two physicists on Oliphant's staff, James Randall and H.A.H. Boot, were in fact developing the cavity magnetron, an electron tube capable of generating intense microwave radiation for ground and airborne radar. In C.P. Snow's assessment, the most valuable English scientific innovation in the Hitler War. Meanwhile, the British Chemical Society asked Frisch to write a review of advances in experimental nuclear physics for its annual report. I managed to write that article in my bedsitter, where in daytime, with the gas fire going all day, the temperature rose to 42 degrees Fahrenheit, while at night, the water froze in the tumbler at my bedside. He wore his winter coat, set his typewriter on his lap, and pulled his chair close to the fire. The radiation from the gas fire stimulated the blood supply to my brain, and the article was completed on time. Frisch's review article mentioned the possibility of a chain reaction only to discount it. He based that conclusion on Bohr's argument that the U-238 in natural uranium would scatter fast neutrons, slowing them to capture resonance energies. The few that escaped capture would not suffice, he thought, to initiate a slow neutron chain reaction in the scarce U-235. Slow neutrons, in any case, could never produce more than a modest explosion, Frisch pointed out. They took too long slowing down and finding a nucleus. As he explained later, that process would take times of the order of a sizable part of a millisecond, that is, a thousandth of a second, and for the whole chain reaction to develop would take several milliseconds. Once the material got hot enough to vaporize, it would begin to expand, and the reaction would be stopped before it got much further. So the thing might blow up like a pile of gunpowder, but no worse, and that wasn't worth the trouble. Not long from Nazi Germany, Frisch found his argument against a violently explosive chain reaction reassuring. It was backed by the work of no less a theoretician than Niels Bohr. With satisfaction, he published it. It had seen the light of day before, most notably in an August 5, 1939 letter from Member of Parliament Winston Churchill to the British Secretary of State for Air. Concerned that Hitler might bluff Neville Chamberlain with threats of a new secret weapon, Churchill had collected a briefing from Frederick Lindemann and written to caution the cabinet not to fear new explosives of devastating power for at least several years. The best authorities, the distinguished MP emphasized with a nod to Niels Bohr, held that only a minor constituent of uranium is effective in these processes. That constituent would need to be laboriously extracted for any large-scale effects. The chain process can take place only if the uranium is concentrated in a large mass, Churchill continued, slightly muddling the point. As soon as the energy develops, it will explode with a mild detonation before any really violent effects can be produced. It might be as good as our present-day explosives, but it is unlikely to produce anything very much more dangerous. He concluded optimistically. Dark hints will be dropped, and terrifying whispers will be assiduously circulated, but it is to be hoped that nobody will be taken in by them. Frisch found a friend that year in a fellow émigré at Birmingham, the theoretician Rudolf Peierls. A well-off Berliner, a slender man with a boyish face, a notable overbite, and a mind of mathematical austerity, Peierls was born in 1907 and had arrived in England in 1933 on a Rockefeller fellowship to Cambridge. With the Nazi purge of the German universities, he chose to remain in England. He would be naturalized as a British citizen in February 1940, but until then he was technically an enemy alien. When Oliphant consulted with him from time to time on the mathematics of resonant cavities, important for microwave radar, both men were careful to pretend that the question was purely academic. Peierls had already contributed significantly to the debate on the possible explosive effects of fission. The previous May, one of Frédéric Joliot's associates in Paris, Francis Perrine, had published a first approximate formula for calculating the critical mass of uranium, the amount of uranium necessary to sustain a chain reaction. A lump smaller than a critical mass would be inert. A lump of critical size would explode spontaneously upon assembly. The possibility of a critical mass is anchored in the fact that the surface area of a sphere increases more slowly with increasing radius than does the volume, as nearly R2 to R3. At some particular volume, depending on the density of the material and on its cross-sections for scattering, capture, and fission, more neutrons should find nuclei to fission than find surface to escape from. That volume is then the critical mass. Estimating the several cross-sections of natural uranium, Francis Perrine put its critical mass at 44 tons. A tamper around the uranium of iron or lead to bounce back neutrons might reduce the requirement, Perrine calculated, to only 13 tons. Peierls saw immediately that he could sharpen Perrine's formula. He did so in a theoretical paper he worked out in May and early June 1939 that the Cambridge Philosophical Society published in its Proceedings in October. Because a critical mass formula based on slow neutron fission would be mathematically complicated, requiring that the characteristics of the moderator be taken into account, Peierls proposed to consider a simplified case. Fission by unmoderated fast neutrons. Plugging in the fission cross-section of natural uranium, which was essentially the fission cross-section of U-238, gave a critical mass, notes Peierls, on the order of tons. As a weapon, an object of that size was too unwieldy to take seriously. There was, of course, no chance of getting such a thing into any aeroplane, and the paper appeared to have no practical significance. Peierls was aware of the British and American concern for secrecy, but in this case he saw no reason not to publish. The USSR opportunistically invaded Finland at the end of November. In the rest of Europe, the strange standoff prevailed that isolationist Idaho Senator William Borah would label the phony war. The Peierlses moved to a larger house. Early in the new year, they generously invited Frisch to live with them. Genia Peierls, who was Russian, took the bachelor Austrian in hand. She ran her house, writes Frisch, with cheerful intelligence, a ringing Manchester voice, and a Russian's sovereign disregard of the definite article. She taught me to shave every day, and to dry dishes as fast as she washed them, a skill that has come in useful many times since. Life at the Peerless' was entertaining, but Frisch walked home through ominous blackouts, so dark that he sometimes stumbled over roadside benches and could distinguish fellow pedestrians only by the glow of the luminous cards they had taken to wearing in their hatbands. Thus reminded of the continuing threat of German bombing, he found himself questioning his confident Chemical Society review. Is that really true, what I have written? Sometime in February 1940, he looked again. There had always been four possible mechanisms for an explosive chain reaction in uranium. 1. Slow neutron fission of U-238. 2. Fast neutron fission of U-238. 3. Slow neutron fission of U-235. And 4. Fast neutron fission of U-235. Bohr's logical distinction between U-238 and thorium on the one hand and U-235 on the other ruled out 1. U-238 was not fissioned by slow neutrons. 2 was inefficient because of scattering and the parasitic effects of the capture resonance of U-238. 3 was possibly applicable to power production, but too slow for a practical weapon. But what about 4? Apparently no one in Britain, France, or the United States had asked the question quite that way before. If Frisch now glimpsed an opening into those depths, he did so because he had looked carefully at isotope separation and had decided it could be accomplished even with so fugitive an isotope as U-235. He was therefore prepared to consider the behavior of the pure substance unalloyed with U-238, as Bohr, Fermi, and even Szilard had not yet been. I wondered, assuming that my Clusius separation tube worked well, if one could use a number of such tubes to produce enough uranium-235 to make a truly explosive chain reaction possible, not dependent on slow neutrons. How much of the isotope would be needed? He shared the problem with Peierls. Peierls had his critical mass formula. In this case, it required the cross-section for fast neutron fission of U-235, a number no one knew, because no one had yet separated a sufficient amount of the rare isotope to determine its cross-section by experiment, the only way the number could be reliably known. Nevertheless, says Peierls, we had read the paper of Bohr and Wheeler and had understood it, and it seemed to convince us that in those circumstances for neutrons in U-235, the cross-section would be dominated by fission. Peierls could state simply what followed. If a neutron hit the U-235 nucleus, something was bound to happen. What followed thus made the cross-section intuitively obvious. It would be more or less the same as the familiar cross-section that expressed the odds of hitting the uranium nucleus with a neutron at all, the geometric cross-section, 10 to the negative 23 square centimeters, an entire order of magnitude larger than the fission cross-section previously estimated for natural uranium, that were small multiples of 10 to the negative 24. Just sort of playfully, Frisch writes, he plugged 10 to the negative 23 cm squared into Peierls' formula. To my amazement, the answer was very much smaller than I had expected. It was not a matter of tons, but something like a pound or two. A volume less than a golf ball for a substance so heavy as uranium. But would that pound or two explode or fizzle? Peierls easily produced an estimate. The chain reaction would have to proceed faster than the vaporizing and swelling of the heating metal ball. Peierls calculated the time between neutron generations, between 1 times 2 times 4 times 8 times 16 times 32 times 64, to be about 4 millionths of a second, much faster than the several thousandths of a second Frisch had estimated for slow neutron fission. Then how destructive was the consequent explosion? Some 80 generations of neutrons, as many as could be expected to multiply before the swelling explosion separated the atoms of U-235 enough to stop the chain reaction, still millionths of a second in total, gave temperatures as hot as the interior of the sun, pressures greater than the center of the earth where iron flows as a liquid. I worked out the results of what such a nuclear explosion would be, says Perils. Both Frisch and I were staggered by them. And finally, practically, could even a few pounds of U-235 be separated from U-238? Frisch writes, I had worked out the possible efficiency of my separation system with the help of Clusius's formula, and we came to the conclusion that with something like 100,000 similar separation tubes, one might produce a pound of reasonably pure uranium-235 in a modest time, measured in weeks. At that point, we stared at each other and realized that an atomic bomb might, after all, be possible. The cost of such a plant, Frisch adds, for perspective, would be insignificant compared with the cost of the war. Look, shouldn't somebody know about that? Frisch then asked Perils. They hastened their calculations to Mark Oliphant. They convinced me, Oliphant testifies. He told them to write it all down. They did, succinctly, in two parts. One part three typewritten pages, the other even briefer. Talking about it made them nervous, Piers recalls. By then it was March, and the exceptional cold had given way to warmer weather. I remember we were writing our memorandum, together in my room in the physics lab on the ground floor. It was a fine day, and the window was open, and while we were discussing the wording, a face suddenly appeared in the open window, and we were a little worried. It turned out that just underneath the window, which was facing south, people were growing some tomato plants, and somebody had been there bending down, inspecting what these plants were doing. The first of the two parts they titled On the Construction of a Super Bomb, based on a nuclear chain reaction in uranium. It was intended, they wrote, to point out and discuss a possibility which seems to have been overlooked in earlier discussions. They proceeded to cover the same ground they had previously covered together in private, noting that the energy liberated by a 5-kilogram bomb would be equivalent to that of several thousand tons of dynamite. They described a simple mechanism for arming the weapon, making the uranium sphere in two parts, which are brought together first when the explosion is wanted. Once assembled, the bomb would explode within a second or less. Springs, they thought, might pull the two small hemispheres together. Assembly would have to be rapid, or the chain reaction would begin prematurely, destroying the bomb but not much else. A byproduct of the explosion, about 20% of its energy, they thought, would be radiation, the equivalent of 100 tons of radium that would be fatal to living beings even a long time after the explosion. Effective protection from the weapon would be hardly possible. The second report, Memorandum on the Properties of a Radioactive Superbomb, a less technical document, was apparently intended as an alternative presentation for non-scientists. This study explored beyond the technical questions of design and production to the strategic issues of possession and use. It managed at the same time both seemly innocence and extraordinary prescience. 1. As a weapon, the superbomb would be practically irresistible. There is no material or structure that could be expected to resist the force of the explosion. 2. Owing to the spreading of radioactive substances with the wind, the bomb could probably not be used without killing large numbers of civilians, and this may make it unsuitable as a weapon for use by this country. 3. It is quite conceivable that Germany is, in fact, developing this weapon. 4. If one works on the assumption that Germany is or will be in the possession of this weapon, it must be realized that no shelters are available.